You're listening to event audio from the Brookings Events Podcast, part of the Brookings Podcast Network. For more in-depth analysis and commentary from Brookings scholars and our guests, go to brookings.edu/podcasts or listen via Apple Podcasts on Spotify or your favorite podcast app. Don't forget to follow us on Twitter at Policy Podcasts.
Hello, everyone. Over the past decade, many countries across the globe have made efforts to expand computer science education. These efforts are often driven by economic interests to promote greater productivity and employment. Though we have good reason to believe all students in the 21st century can benefit from these learning opportunities, regardless of whether they go on to work in computing or technology fields. Hello and welcome to today's discussion on expanding computer science education for a technologically advancing world. This event is hosted by Brookings' Center on Universal Education. And I'm Mike Hansen, Senior Fellow in the Brown Center on Education Policy at the Brookings Institution and the Herman and George R. Brown Chair in Education Studies. Our conversation today explores how school systems across the globe can approach the challenge of expanding computer science education for all students. Just yesterday, the Center for Universal Education at Brookings published a new report titled Building School Skills for Life: How to Expand and Improve Computer Science Education Around the World. We are pleased to hear a presentation of this report from one of the report's authors, followed by a panel discussion of invited experts who are helping to inform the implementation process of CS education in various nations. Those listening live in our virtual audience are invited to participate in today's conversation by using the hashtag ComputerScienceEDU. That's hashtag ComputerScienceEDU on Twitter, or you may submit questions via email at events, that's EVENTS, at brookings.edu. We'll be monitoring both the hashtag and the inbox for questions, and we will be pulling from those questions during the Q&A portion of today's discussion. Now, before getting on to the presentation and discussion, we are pleased to hear some opening remarks from Hadi Partovi, CEO of Code.org, a nonprofit organization promoting computer science in the U.S. and globally. Full disclosure, Code.org provides generous support to the Center for Universal Education's Leadership Council. I want to explicitly state that Brookings has a commitment to independence, and the views expressed today are those solely of the speakers. Hadi?
Hi, my name is Hadi Partovi, and I'm the founder and CEO of Code.org and the creator of the Global Hour of Code campaign. I couldn't be happier for today's launch. As many of you know, Code.org is an organization dedicated to expanding access to computer science in schools and increasing participation by young women and students from other underrepresented groups. Our vision is that every student in every school should have the opportunity to learn computer science. The work that the Brookings Institution is presenting today brings together for the first time a global view of the state of computer science education in formal education systems. I want to first acknowledge the leadership of Emiliana Vegas and Mike Hansen, who co-authored the report. And I want to thank the Brookings team, who dived into the education systems for months to understand computer science education in each country. Their research confirms what we knew anecdotally in terms of best practices and gaps, and it sheds light on new and promising efforts, as well as areas of opportunity. It is also a timely study, as the COVID pandemic has forced society to rethink the learning experience. Because as we think about coming out of this pandemic, it is so clear that we need computer science to be part of the new normal. This new reality has accelerated the need to change how our children learn and what they learn. Our schools should teach the curriculum of the future, not just the curriculum of the past. In an increasingly digital world, learning computer science will help students understand better how the world works, in the same way that all of us studied biology, chemistry, or physics as foundational subjects. Since I started doing this work in 2013, we've seen so many countries embark on the journey of adopting a computer science curriculum, but there's still so much work to be done. While we can't predict what our workforce needs will be in the middle of the century, what we already know is that the workforce is changing and is continuing to do so with the rate of technological advancement. To equip all students with the creative, collaborative, and digital problem-solving skills that allow them to succeed in the future, schools need to teach computer science as part of the core curriculum for every student. These skills aren't just crucial for technical careers in the developed world. They're valuable increasingly for every job in every economy. Unfortunately, the majority of schools still don't offer computer science. We need innovative solutions to support our students better for what lies ahead. And that means teaching students how to create technology and acquire the technical skills they will need for most jobs and in all industries. I learned that in my own personal experience. You know, I grew up in Tehran, Iran during the Iran-Iraq War. And when my family came to the United States as an immigrant, my family was poor. I was learning a new language and a culture. But because I was really good at coding and computer science, I could start working as a summer intern at tech companies as young as 15 years old. And by the time I was 26 years old, I was starting my own company. The opportunity and path that I've had is not because of anything other than my understanding of computer science. Now, teaching computer science in schools may sound intimidating, but it is an idea that generates hope. It inspires teachers and it engages students. And even though the majority of the world's teachers don't have experience in computer science, and many of the world's schools lack connected computers, these are problems we can and should solve. As the Brookings study shows, these are problems that many developed and developing countries from various continents are establishing plans to solve, and the rest of the world should follow suit. The future of work may be uncertain, but one thing is certain. Computer science will be in greater demand than ever before, and that is why every student in every school should have an opportunity to learn it as part of their school curriculum and acquire the skills that will be key for them to succeed in the future. Thank you so much.
And thank you, Hadi, for those opening remarks. We're now pleased to hear from Emiliana Vegas, Senior Fellow and Co-Director of the Center for Universal Education here at Brookings, and also one of the co-authors of the new report. A leading expert on education in developing countries, Dr. Vegas has written extensively on issues affecting education systems in Latin America and the Caribbean and other developing regions, spanning topics ranging from policies to raise teacher effectiveness, school finance, and early childhood development policies. Before joining Brookings, Vegas served as the chief of the education division at the Inter-American Development Bank, the IDB, and at various positions at the World Bank. Emiliana, the time is yours.
Thank you so much, Mike. It's a pleasure to have the opportunity to present on our behalf the main findings of our study. Let me share my screen. Here we go. Okay, is that working for everyone? Yes? For some reason. Let's see. Can everybody see it? Okay, here we go. So our report is titled Building Skills for Life, How to Expand and Improve Computer Science Education Around the World. And I am delighted that Mike is moderating an excellent panel of people who have helped us inform this report and who have worked, as he said, in countries around the world. I'm here to present the main findings of the report. And I'll start by giving you a sense of the structure. So the first third of the report focuses on the motivation. Why expand computer science education? And we settle on three main arguments. The first is an economic argument. The second is an argument that providing and expanding access to computer science education will help reduce inequality across and within countries. And finally, that more than economics, computer science education can also provide skills that are valuable for life. A second third of the report is a review of the extent to which countries around the world have expanded computer science education in K through 12, and also an analysis of the key challenges they had faced in doing so. And based on this analysis, we selected 11 jurisdictions from different parts of the world at different levels of economic development, and all of which have attempted to expand computer science education, but are also at different stages of doing so. And so we took a deep dive and drew some key lessons from those experiences that we hope will help inform policymakers around the world. So let me start by giving you the motivation. We believe there are three main reasons why expanding computer science education today is an urgent endeavor. First, computer science education pays off. It pays off both for countries at the macro level and for individuals at the microeconomic level. Second, computer science education prepares. It promises to enhance student preparedness for the future, not just as Mike said, and Hadi also referred to this, to prepare engineers, but in learning computer science education, individuals learn a host of skills that are valuable for almost any job in today's economy and certainly for the future. And finally, it benefits. A functional knowledge of how computers work will benefit all students in this world and in the future, where computers and technology permeate every aspect of our lives. So let me start with the economic argument. So in this graph, what we did is present a correlation of the relationship in the horizontal axis of the percent of graduates from information communication technology related fields. And then in the vertical axis, the country's GDP per capita growth. And what we see is a positive trend line. That is, the greater the percentage of graduates in a country who have these skills, the greater the likelihood that that country is growing at a faster rate. At the individual level, and this is data from the United States, we also found that workers who have computer science skills have both higher employment and higher average wages than their peers who don't have them. So beyond the economic argument, as we said, we also found that there are benefits in terms of preparing and a host of other skills such as collaboration, communication, self-confidence, problem solving, creativity that individuals learn by acquiring computer science skills. But then what is the status of progress around the world in expanding computer science education? And so in this world map, what we did is look at the official documents of curricular reforms and current efforts across the world to introduce computer science education in K through 12. And what we found is that a minority of countries in dark blue have expanded to the extent that they have made mandatory computer science education in both primary and secondary schools. Then there are some countries shaded in light blue in this map who have mandated computer science education either in primary or in secondary schools. In light green, we have countries where computer science education is available as an optional subject for students to take in most districts. In yellow, it's systems where computer science education is available in some schools or in some districts, but not in all. And in orange are countries where computer science education is just being introduced or there's an announcement around its introduction. And finally, where we have shaded is systems, whether they have mandatory computer science education in primary and secondary or in one or the other, or whether it's optional, but where it is taught as a cross-curricular subject. So what are the key takeaways from our, let's say, landscape analysis of the extent of expansion of computer science education around the world? The first quite obvious one is that students living in higher income countries generally have better access to computer science education. But also within high income countries, we found that disadvantaged populations who would most benefit from CS education, such as ethnic and racial minorities, girls and young women, are often excluded, especially in the early grades. So we believe there are important lessons. And also we then explored what were some of the challenges that countries that have attempted to expand computer science education have faced. And we identified four key challenges. So a first challenge, which is primarily faced by low middle income countries, is that not all schools have adequate access to devices and connectivity. But this is also true of low-income areas and high-income countries. So it's a common challenge that we found across all systems in the world. The second very common challenge is that even when there's the political will and the social demand for expanding computer science education, ensuring that there are qualified teachers through teacher preparation and qualification is still a challenge for all countries. The third important challenge is that even as they expand and as they provide more offer in computer science courses, there's a need to foster student interest in taking these courses, particularly among students from historically underserved communities. And finally, developing and using evidence on curriculum and core competencies, effective instructional methods, and assessment of computer science education skills is very important. And it's something that prevents, I think, us from better understanding what are the most effective methods and assessment. However, there's been recent research that is shedding light into these issues that we refer to in our report. So in order to understand how countries that have expanded computer science education in K-12, we selected 11 jurisdictions, as I mentioned, that are at different levels of economic development, that are at different stages of their expansion of computer science education, and also from various regions of the world, from Chile to South Africa, Thailand, and Uruguay. And in today's panel, we'll have representatives from some of these countries to help explain in more detail what were some of the ways in which they addressed these challenges. But from our review, we identified six key lessons. The first is that when countries had a national economic development strategy based on expanding technology-based jobs, this created a momentum and served as a powerful lever to expand computer science education in K-12. Second, that countries that had invested in introducing devices and connectivity in schools were better placed to then focus on the quality of the teaching, which is the third big challenge that absolutely all countries have faced and are continuing to figure out how to address, which is how to develop the qualified teachers for CS education. This should be a priority. It needs to be thought through quite carefully, as we don't want to repeat mistakes from developing world where access to education has been expanded, but in many cases without the needed quality. The fourth key lesson is that exposing students early to computer science education helps foster their interest and excitement. Once we wait until, upper secondary or even lower secondary, it may be too late to foster the interest, particularly of girls and underserved minorities. So efforts that some of these countries have undertaken to introduce early and particularly focused on these groups have proven to be quite successful. The fifth key lesson is that engaging key stakeholders can help address some of the bottlenecks, both in the first and the second challenge that we identified. So in many of the countries we reviewed, partnerships with industry, with civil society organizations, with non-governmental organizations, helped the government expand computer science education through better access to infrastructure and even better access to human resource capacity. And finally, our sixth key lesson is that when taught in an interactive, hands-on way, computer science education builds skills for life. As we've all mentioned, and technology permeates every aspect of our life. So there's a natural curiosity of students to understand how it works. And when it's taught in an interactive way, there are these exciting other competencies that are so useful for any job, any career in today's and its world, as well as in the future, including collaboration, creativity, problem solving, confidence, and communication. So that's, in a very short summary, the key findings from our report, and we invite you to look at it at our website. Thank you, Mike.
Thank you, Emiliana. Let's now proceed to the panel discussion. Presently, I'm being joined by four guests who have been involved in helping school systems across the globe implement computer science education in their own ways, and I'll introduce each of them to you individually. First, Shuchi Grover is Senior Research Scientist and Chief Learning Officer at Looking Glass Ventures. She is a learning scientist and computer science education researcher, formerly at SRI International's Center for Technology and Learning. Grover has engaged in computer science and STEM education and research for school-aged children for over two decades. She has extensively studied CS teaching and learning in informal as well as formal K-12 settings through the design of curriculum, assessment tools, and environments that help develop 21st century competencies. Welcome, Shuchi. Next, we have Maria Florencia Ripani, who is the director of Fundación Ceibal. The Ceibal Foundation is an NGO committed to promoting research, innovation, and knowledge building on technology and education, which was created by Plan Ceibal, the National Digital Education Program in Uruguay. The foundation develops and promotes research and best practice in digital education and public policy across Uruguay and Latin America. Florencia was previously the National Director of Innovation at the Ministry of Education in Argentina, where she led the integration of ICT, programming, and robotics into compulsory education. Next, we have Sue Sentence, who is director of the Raspberry Pi Computing Education Research Center at the University of Cambridge in the UK, and she's the Chief Learning Officer for Raspberry Pi Foundation. Dr. Sentence received her PhD in artificial intelligence from Edinburgh University in 1993, and since then has worked as a secondary teacher, a teacher trainer, a university lecturer, and researcher before joining the Raspberry Pi Foundation in 2018. At the Raspberry Pi Foundation, Sue's role is to advise on teaching and learning and lead on research on computing education for young people. And our final guest is Panuakdet Suwanathat. Mr. Suwanathat, who also goes by Mok, is a researcher at King Mongkut's University of Technology, Thonburi in Thailand. He has a master's degree in computer science from the University of California, Santa Barbara, and since returning to Thailand in 2016, has been involved with the introduction and development of the computing science curriculum there. He was part of the National Curriculum Committee and has authored multiple primary school textbooks by adopting a cartoon-based approach to teaching computational thinking. He also writes for Maha Sanuk Happy Learners, a cartoon periodical that teaches essential future skills to children under the column Fun with Coding. Thank you to the four of you for joining in today's conversation. And once again, I remind those of you in the audience that you can participate in today's conversation by using hashtag ComputerScienceEDU for comments and questions, or send an email to events@brookings.edu. First, let's begin the discussion by exploring issues of curriculum. One of the lessons from the report is that though many countries are making progress to adopt CS education, we don't see a lot of convergence on exactly how to structure CS education. Some countries introduce standalone CS courses, others integrate it into other subject curricula like math or science. Some countries might prioritize early exposure while others prioritize exposure in later years. Shuchi, I'll give this question to you first. What do we know about the pros and cons of these various approaches to CS education, and how do they impact students?
Sure. I imagine what we're talking about now is what goes on in the classroom. And I have to say that it is hard to disentangle issues of curriculum and instruction from the broader ecosystem of teacher preparation and rollout of computing and policy, et cetera. But I will just focus on research on learning of computing. And so whenever we think about a subject, especially a new subject, we have to think about the why, what, and how. And the why has just been laid out in this report, in fact, in the things that Emiliana talked about. The what is the content that we wish to teach in computing. I think there's a fair amount of consensus on the topics that need to be taught over the K-12 journey. These have been articulated in things like the K-12 computer science framework in the US, standards defined by CSTA and the Computer Science Teachers Association, which is a global body, and state standards and similar, frameworks and documents that have been articulated in other countries. And these basically speak to concepts and practices of computer science. These are content areas and skills, as well as things like computational thinking and problem solving skills, and how to approach you know, designing a problem that a computer is going to basically enact. In terms of practices, we have ways of doing it in unplugged ways, which don't require a computer. And there are ways in which you can even teach coding without a computer, but there are, of course, benefits from that accrue from actually working with a computer. So one of the things that I want to say from research is that you can use both unplugged as well as plugged activities. And in fact, both ought to be used, because from the learning sciences, we do get a sense that the more students encounter concepts in various contexts, the better their understanding grows of certain ideas. And that also connects to the idea of integrating computing into other subjects. While it's beneficial to teach it as a standalone subject, because you can address issues of, you know, the computer science content as well as skills of programming, when you sort of integrate it into another subject, there are concerns of the field of the other subject and domain that you can sort of interrogate through things like programming and coding. And so that provides a very good context for learning coding and programming. And you're also examining issues in innovative ways and answering questions that you couldn't do without sort of, using computational tools and code. And so, you know, both have their pros and cons, both have their benefits. I would say that in the K-12 journey, students should encounter computer science learning, both in unplugged and plugged ways, in context, within subjects and outside of, you know, as a standalone subject, because that's when you sort of understand core issues of computing, whether it's networks, internet, privacy, those kinds of things. And another point that I would say from research is that there are tools that have been designed over the last couple of decades or so that work well for novice learners. Block-based programming environments have been shown to be beneficial and engaging for novice learners, given all the research done in the 80s and 90s around the difficulties children face, when they're sort of thrown into a text-based programming environment. So physical computing, block-based programming, these have all been found to be more engaging and motivating for learners. So that is another area that, you know, ought to be sort of thought about when you're sort of introducing computer science to children. But I should say, again, from research, we know that tools alone don't teach. You have to have thoughtfully designed curriculum and progressions. There are several exemplars here in the US and across the countries that you all have, you know, sort of looked at in the course of writing your report, where there are, you know, these are open education resources. Most of the tools are open source. And so there's a lot that people can, you know, people across can learn from each other. And the last point that I want to say is that research has sort of looked a lot at the how, you know, the pedagogy of teaching computing. There are several techniques that have sort of looked at both the disciplinary aspects of computing, but also the affective aspects of learning computing, motivation, engagement, identity development. And given our concerns for equity, there are frameworks that have sort of been articulated by KPOR Center in recent months, the Raspberry Pi Foundation, that look at culturally relevant pedagogies and culturally relevant teaching practices, which basically empower learners to learn computing in ways that sort of build identity, build their interest and sort of push them to sort of question structures that have historically sort of kept them out of this important field. And so I don't want to take too much time, but I think I've covered a lot of aspects of curriculum and instruction, and I hope those are helpful.
Yeah, yes, thank you, Suchi. That was a very helpful overview. Maybe let's turn to Sue quickly. Sue, so there is a lot of, as Suchi describes, a very large body of research here. Do you feel like we are converging on any set of best practices here in this space? And what are you seeing there in the UK with the Raspberry Pi Foundation?
I think we're a little way off. So I don't know if I quite agree with Suchi that we reach a consensus of what we should be teaching. I think that we are we have been starting to research, and definitely the increase of research in this area is really good to see. Through our work in England, we've been able to try things out on sort of quite a large scale, because we have the curriculum rolled out, you know, for that, for the whole, you know, primary and secondary school across the country. So we are embedding, you know, sort of research informed pedagogies through our curriculum, and so that over time we'll be able to have a much clearer view of, you know, what are appropriate ways and engaging ways to teach computing. I think also we need to be continually critical and not complacent. You know, we have, you know, this AI and data science and all these areas, you know, it's sort of going to be very, very important in future years to the young people leaving our schools. So we need to be continually questioning what we're teaching and whether it's relevant, and that we are really engaging with the culturally responsive, equitable approaches to teaching that Shushi mentioned.
Thank you, Sue. Florencia, I'd like to direct the next question to you. Shushi mentioned both unplugged and plugged versions of CS education. Unplugged refers to covering the skills and the concepts without necessarily using a device as an instrument of teaching. I want to ask you, Florencia, in your experience, I know that expanding access to devices and connectivity has been a major priority for Ceibal Foundation. And why did you focus on providing that access? And would you have been able to do that just providing an unplugged version in Uruguay?
Well, first of all, in Uruguay, you know that the main strategy of Ceibal Plan is a one-to-one program. So that means that every student from primary and lower secondary schools have access to a computerized device, together with educational resources, connectivity at every school, facilities to connect from remote facilities, and a number of pedagogical services. So in that sense, all the programs which provides a Ceibal Plan, which are related to computer science, are voluntary and mainly plugged, because all students have access to devices. So that is not necessarily a problem for Uruguay. But obviously the country faces some of the challenges that Emiliana mentioned during her presentation, such as trained teachers to deliver computational thinking, programming, and robotics classes that Ceibal Plan currently offers to state schools across Uruguay. And what Ceibal Plan has strategically implemented is a remote teaching offer, which combines the knowledge of remote teachers very knowledgeable in computer science with teachers who are located at schools, and they jointly lead the projects. And it has proved to be successful both for computational thinking programs and for English teaching as a foreign language. There are many other aspects to mention, such as the involvement in international activities and the creation of an ecosystem, which helps to deliver a program which impacts in more than 50% of primary schools in cities in Uruguay.
Excellent. Thank you, Florencia. Mark, I've got a question for you. I know that you have been invested in developing curricular resources for young learners in Thailand. And why the focus on young learners, Mark?
Oh, okay. So in Thailand, we roll out the curriculum starting in about 2017, right? So, and we have wrestled with some decisions on whether or not to make it mandatory for the secondary education only, or including the primary education. But I think the decision by the by the Ministry of Education has been correct in requiring from the primary school students from grade one to learn computer science, because it turns out that it's easier to make it engaging to young students when they start young, because once they have their hands on the unplugged activities, they feel like it's a game. Unlike when they learn other subjects that are like they see a lot of numbers in math or some other like some other deep concepts in other subjects, they get turned off by the difficulty. But in computer science, for it's like a new kind of activity for them that they can touch, they can feel, they can play it with their friends, they can try to make it make the commands. Bring the robot to the destination, like using stuff that they can touch and they can move around a board, like a board game. So they feel that this subject is more like a game than a very difficult coding session. And once they have learned to have engagement and interest, like the third point that you make in the report here, student engagement and interest, it's much easier for the qualified teachers to bring them into a deeper understanding of the concepts. So we feel that that is the correct way to go. And by bringing cartoons and story into the classroom, having the students, the little kids, complete missions on behalf of the correct cartoon characters in the textbooks, they feel that they have accomplished something. They have helped their friends accomplish something, like as simple as buying some ice cream, for example. So I feel that that's the correct way to go. But of course, there are some other details that we have not decided whether what is the correct way to do it. Like, should it be a separate subject or should it integrate with all subjects like some other countries do? We don't have like a consensus yet on what to do going forward, and we are in the process of revising the curriculum, the national curriculum, even now, and we have not decided on what to go forward.
Thank you, Mark. So it sounds like from all of our panelists that we don't have a lot of consensus. There's still a lot of room for experimentation. Here's a question that from an audience member that just came in. Sabine from the IDB asks, how can social emotional skills be integrated into a CS program? Of course, this is still experimental, but incorporating social emotional learning into CS, I don't know if that's something that any of you have addressed. Maybe Shuchi, can you quickly address that one? You want to unmute yourself.
Okay. Thank you. So a lot of curricula have actually research projects have actually looked at socio-emotional skills. So when we're talking about socio-emotional, I guess we have to first define what it is we're talking about. If we're talking about basically affective skills affective skills like motivation and interest and learner agency, identity, and also social, you know, the social collaboration and communication and those kinds of things. I think there is a fair amount of research that has gone into looking at things like working on collaborative projects, project-based learning, which brings in students' interests into the projects that they're doing. When you're engaging girls, for example, providing contexts that are socially and, you know, consequential and meaningful activities, projects that sort of connect to communities and issues of social justice. So tying into students' lives, tying into students' doing projects that tie that bring students' communities and learners' cultures into the classroom, build and even their interests. So, you know, youth projects around social media, music, those kinds of things that children like. I think there is a lot that has been done, and especially tools like physical computing tools like Scratch, block-based programming. Mobile app inventor, that programming environment for designing apps and things like that. There's a ton that can be done in a computer science classroom that really brings all of this, social emotional aspects of of learning. So.
Okay, thanks, Shruti. Sue, do you want to pile in on that?
I was just going to add something around confidence building. I mean, I don't know if anybody in the audience has tried to program and given up. You know, I mean, it's you know, or had programs that have failed and then they feel really rubbish. You know, we're asking children to be learning this from an early age, and this will be their experience unless we really think about pedagogy that, you know, is carefully scaffolded, gradually builds on what children know already, and enables them to sort of, you know, gain that confidence. I mean, that's where some of the devices help, be able to get more feedback from a physical device and that sort of thing to build your confidence. And we need teachers that are confident, and because a teacher that can't hide the fact if they're really nervous about teaching a subject and they don't really feel on solid ground or their knowledge is fragile, then the young people pick that up. So I was just going to add to Shruti's excellent comprehensive answer those kind of aspects.
Yeah, thank you for that. Let's pivot a little bit and now focus on exploring the politics of implementing a CS program in a country or across a school system. One of the key lessons that we describe in the report is that countries at the vanguard of implementing universal CS education typically had a combination of both political leadership and an outside partnership with those in the technology sector to really push for adoption of these systems. However, there are risks from leaning too heavily on the technology sector for leadership in CS education. For example, let's go to Mok. Thailand has engaged with multiple external partners. What can be done to keep the influence of commercial companies in check to ensure that students' learning is kept as a central focus in these initiatives?
Yeah, Thailand has been very lucky in that when big companies support education in coding in Thailand, we have not seen a push to lock in the technology. They move in a more collaborative manner. For example, it's not like Microsoft, when Microsoft supports coding education, they try to make everyone learn .NET framework. It's not like that. They try to support learning computer science as building up computational thinking skills. And this is true for other big companies as well. So it's been great in that way. And also the telecommunication companies, many companies in Thailand have come together and help expand access to broadband internet access and ICT devices for students in Thailand, which still are one of the big challenges in some areas. But that challenge of the lack of devices has been shrinking steadily over time, because that is one problem that easy to improve, because if they lack devices, we just give them devices. And if they lack network, we just build more network. But the lack of teachers, of qualified teachers, and the continued development of teachers, that is one area that private companies alone cannot make it happen if it's not for the joint effort by various government agencies. So that's one way that and also I want to mention that the curriculum in Thailand has been developed with the explicit focus that we want to develop teaching and thinking, logical thinking skill for the students, and not for the skill to code in any particular language or technology. So it's more like a generic computational thinking skill rather than in some specific language technology.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, thank you for that, Mok. So one of the questions that that we noticed as we were putting this report together is that we see some areas of resistance, particularly in lower income countries, resistance to the idea of expanding universal computer science education and the necessity of doing so when numeracy and literacy lag behind. So for example, Florencia, I'm gonna ask you this question. This is an audience question that comes from Syed Ahmad from the Citizens Foundation, who asks, how can we ensure 21st century skills are learned in low-income countries where they lack electricity, equipment, and competent personnel? how can we really bridge the gap to CS education in these contexts? And is it worth it?
Well, it's a good question with a complex answer, maybe. I think it's a challenge, mainly because in many aspects, there are many activities which can be unplugged. But at a certain point, it is important to access a computerized device to develop certain skills related to computer science. And that's a challenge for many countries, particularly in rural schools. There are some alternatives. Some are related to cooperation between governments and the private sector, and also working with the resources that are available. That will certainly imply certain constraints, but we have a history of big projects supported by international organizations, which are very ambitious and involve quite expensive resources and a big deployment of infrastructure and connectivity. And that tends to be a challenge because it is difficult to develop projects with equal access for all countries and all areas. And it's difficult to find a sustainable projection of these projects. So one of the possible areas would be combining unplugged teaching resources with the usage of the type of devices that are available at vulnerable families, homes, such as mobile phones, and working jointly with different organizations involving public and private cooperation in order to provide as many resources and teaching teachers preparation as possible. But it's really complex and necessary for social mobility.
Yeah, thank you. Florencia. As a bit of a follow-up for that, I've got a bit of a pithy question that comes to us from David at mb.gov. And David asks, how do we convince the powers that be that thinking like a coder is foundational to being literate and numerate? It's a bit of a pithy question, but it sounds like David is arguing that thinking like a coder is necessary to being successful in literacy and numeracy as well. Shuchi, do you want to weigh in on that one just briefly?
Sure, absolutely. I think literacy and numeracy certainly have their place. But in today's world, computing is as foundational as literacy, as foundational a literacy as reading and writing, I think. And I think to countries, and just going back to the previous question, if you only focus on reading and writing, then your children and your countries will get left behind. That is what the data are showing. And so you have to find ways of combining both. And in terms of thinking, in today's world, thinking like a coder is as much a fundamental as foundational and understanding as reading and writing, because the world is surrounded by computing. And so if you are not able to sort of decode this digital world around you, then you are not going to be able to participate fully in the future. So
thank you for that response, Shuchi. We have just a few more minutes before we go on to audience Q&A, but let's quickly pivot to questions about teacher capacity. So one of the things that we found in conducting this report is that there's a bit of a chicken and egg nature when it comes to the dilemma of training teachers. For example, if we have put CS policies in place, we could provide a real incentive to train teachers, though policymakers may hesitate in some ways to implement aggressive CS policies because the current labor capacity is low. Are there any suggestions on how we can break through this stalemate? Sue, what is the experience that you've seen in the UK?
Yeah, so we've had experience of this because we put in the curriculum in 2014 across the board and sort of trained teachers as we went. We had got some pre-service teacher education before the curriculum change in ICT and computer science. So we had the kind of the teachers being trained to go in, but there was a large body of teachers in England who didn't have the computer science subject knowledge for part of the computing curriculum that we were introducing. So the government has funded teacher education, as you've written in your report, some at the beginning and then increasing. And we have learned to use a very holistic approach to teacher development. So in the early days, we used a master teachers, which were a sort of peer-to-peer kind of approach, encourage teachers sort of supporting each other. We've been very fortunate the government has rolled out, a large teacher education program in the National Centre for Computing Education with online training, which is at scale, with in-person training or asynchronous training, which is more individualised. Then we have a school-led model where schools together work on their curriculum and are looked sort of supported by other schools around them. So we have a certification process where teachers can be certified. We have an action research course to enable teachers to explore what works in their own classrooms. So I do think that from our experience, this idea of a sort of a multi-pronged approach to tackle this really quite significant problem is better than saying, right, we'll just run this course with all of our teachers, that we need to be sort of flexible to adapt to local situations. And most importantly, to kind of, and I don't know if we've done this successfully right from the beginning, but to bring, to bring teachers along. And one of the things that the Computing at School Network did was provide this kind of bottom-up network of teachers enabled, feeling sort of empowered to support each other and to set things up in their school. The difficulty is that whether the gap between the top down and the bottom up. So you need the government to provide teacher education programs. You need teachers to feel like this isn't just something that's done to them and that they belong, that they feel enthusiastic about and can work with, and it can be good for them and they can support other teachers. And what you don't want is a gap between this kind of the top down and the bottom up. So I don't know if we have all the answers, but we certainly have a lot of experience through the computer curriculum in England.
Thank you, Sue. And on that point, maybe let's turn to Mock very quickly. So Sue was just mentioning how there's a bit of a gap, or there could arise a gap, let's say that, between the government's desire to train the teachers and the teachers' willingness to sort of go along with these new trainings. And this is an audience question. Simon from Lincolnshire Prairie View 103 asks, if having a dedicated CS teacher at the primary and elementary level is not an option, how do we go about integrating CS education into the classroom when teachers already feel overwhelmed with their other demands?
Okay, so thank you for the question. So in Thailand, we have trained both the specific CS teachers in school and also teachers who normally teach in other subjects, such as general science and mathematics, to teach computing science as well. And we learned from that program that teachers who teach other subjects and come to the training have a wider variety of tools to integrate computer science teaching into their own subjects, such as like a STEM projects or mathematics concept teaching together with computer science concept. So that becomes a boon to them because they make the projects and the homework in their classroom more fun and more engaging when we have like a computational thinking element in it. So we try to make it that way. But of course, this is all a work in progress and we still have a long way to go. And in many ways, we kind of follow the UK's model in having like master teachers and a network of teachers, but we are in a much smaller scale at this point. But we are trying to break the critical point where we have enough teachers to inspire other teachers who feel that teaching computer science is fun, it's good for students, and they want to teach it too. So we're getting there, hopefully.
Okay, thank you. let's go to audience Q&A. And well, as we do this, why don't we try to get as many questions as we can. Let's do some sort of rapid response from our panelists. Let me first go to you, Florencia. Christian from Roland Hall asks, how can we help create tech career pathways out of high school for underserved students?
Well, I think California has been doing that for a while. It's a very interesting resource. And that, I think there are some for the curriculum in many countries to implement this, because there are some subjects which are compatible with career path. And the experiences that I know and I have explored involved the private sector participation, for example, video game companies who help teachers to deliver video game courses about video game production. And that gives tools for specific, for the development of specific skills, which are related to students' expectations and also needed for life and work and are very relevant for their future. So I think one of the key points is to understand how this could be implemented in the national or local curriculums to create the necessary partnerships with those who know about those skills, and also to give options to students so they can choose something that they really like and that they really feel committed to, and they can experience a very interesting journey in their learning experience.
Okay, thanks. Thanks, Florencia. We have a question from Juliet on Twitter who comments, I'm noticing a lot of conflation between coding and having computer science skills, but is there a difference between the two? Maybe Sue, can you address that?
There certainly is. Yes, and that is one of the problems that we've had in the media, that the two get conflated. But even programming and coding, I think, are different things. So my answer to this one is, the difference between coding and programming is that programming is the sort of taking of a problem, designing a solution, and then when you've got your solution and you've got an algorithm and then you put it into code, that's coding. So that's the difference between coding and programming. Programming is only one aspect of computer science, so no, we can't conflate the two, but people do because the language is a little bit blurry in our field.
Okay, thank you. And thank you. Here's a question from Jane that came in. I'll maybe direct this one to you, Shushi. How important is computer science education research to the CS education agenda? And what should we be doing to develop a pipeline of researchers?
I think that this is a great question. I think universities and academia, computer science departments need to be sort of addressing this. I think industry and policymakers and research, grant funding institutions like the National Science Foundation have been sort of developing this field around computer science education. But again, if computer science departments don't recognize this, it will be difficult. It is something that I think the field is sort of grappling with, because unless we know how to teach computer science well, it will always sort of suffer as a bona fide subject to be taught. And I think, again, it becomes a collective effort. It's an ecosystem that has brought computer science into classrooms. I think it will be the broader ecosystems, industry, academia, grant, policy making bodies and grant funding institutions that have to sort of make this this possible. I certainly sort of am behind this as computer science education researchers ourselves. We sort of, I think Sue has actually been involved in doing a fair amount of work in the UK around sort of rallying, the government and other bodies to sort of create an ecosystem for research. In the US, of course, the National Science Foundation has funded a lot of the work around computer science education, but CS education as a field itself of study has to be given a little more priority, I think, by computer science departments.
So. Yeah, thank you. Thank you for that, Shuchi. Now, as we sort of have run out of time, but I'm just going to go around the horn one last time to see maybe 15 seconds. Sue, why don't you give us a quick last word, and then we'll let Mark and Florencia also join in.
Okay, well, I'm just really, really pleased with this report and the key findings. You know, get computing in early into the curriculum, make it mandatory, train teachers, and, you know, those messages, develop, you know, sort of the aspects of the infrastructure in the ecosystem. I think those messages, and I think we all need to work in partnership. Those of us who are sort of further along, we work in partnerships with countries that are sort of on the way, because it's so important that computer science reaches all children.
Thanks, Sue. And Mark?
Yeah,
closing thoughts?
I think the most important thing is that we have to make the students believe that this is fun. And this is not maybe not too difficult for everyone. Like, you don't have to be a genius to learn computer science. And that's what we have to strive to do.
Thanks. And Florencia?
Something very brief. I would like to mention the importance of empowering students and creating an ecosystem for teaching computer science. And I will just mention that Uruguay has just released a long film, which is called We Dream of Robots. It's a long documentary that shows the transformation of students from rural schools through all the way during the time they developed the robotics program of Sable Plan, and how their lives were transformed by this experience. So I would recommend you watch that film, which is available online.
Thanks, Florencia. And one final thought, Shuchi?
I think it's been great to be involved in this effort. I just want to reiterate the broader message that the report, as well as Hadi, shared, that to understand, be an active participant in, and shape a future that is becoming overwhelmingly digital, computer science is essential, but we don't want to leave anybody behind. So do it in ways where we actually do it such that computer science is for all, in all countries and within countries, for all students.
Thank you, Shuchi. I appreciate it. Thank you to all of our panelists for your participation. I want to also thank Emiliana and Hadi for their appearances earlier. Thanks also to Katie Portnoy and Lorena Masonette and Dan on our Brookings AV team for helping to put this event together. That wraps up our conversation on CS education and its importance in providing a 21st century education. Have a great day, everyone.